So this is the third of this little series of talks about aspects of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. And so far, the Pacific Ocean has figured quite a bit in the first two talks. And over the years, I've flown across the Pacific on a number of occasions. And I think three times from Los Angeles to Auckland. And that really made me aware of just how vast the Pacific is. The flight time is, I think, 13 plus hours. And you cover about 6,500 miles, which is getting on for 10,500 kilometres. And very often when I've done it, I've taken off from the US in the evening, and because you're going westwards, you're, as it were, chasing the sunset. So you have a very, very long night. Just goes on for hour after hour after hour. And there's something about it that's really sort of stayed with me, just being in this great bird, this huge plane, flying through the night across this vast ocean. When you look out, there's hardly anything. It's just the occasional island here and there. And, lots of sleeping passengers. Some still watching yet another in-flight movie, but a lot of them just asleep as this great bird flies across the Pacific. So this links us to the previous two talks. And in the first talk in this series called Wayfinding, I used the story of Pacific navigators called wayfinders who have this extraordinary training where they learn to navigate across large distances without a compass, without any instruments, just through very, very fine attunement to all the conditions that they're under. The sun, the moon, the stars, the wind, the ocean currents, and so on. And I use this as a kind of analogy for going for refuge to the Three Jewels. Undertaking the journey to the farther shore of liberation from the very insecure position in which we currently find ourselves. And then last week, we looked at the insight dimension in a talk called The Empty Boat. And this insight aspect involves going from reflection and developing right view to direct experience, direct knowing of how things are. And amongst quite a lot of other points, I touched on stream entry and also on how after you've had some measure of insight, there are pitfalls such as becoming identified with me, the one who knows how things are. And to move towards insight, we need to get a feeling for the difference between the world of the wayfinders, intimately involved with their actual experience, in which everything is very simple, just very direct. This wave, this feeling of the wind coming from this direction on my cheek. The difference between that and the world of concepts, which are very complex and actually quite inconsistent when we go into it. A very good example of this has been when I've flown the other way across the Pacific. You take off from Auckland in New Zealand, say it's 7:30 in the evening. You fly for about 13 hours. And you arrive in Los Angeles about 10:45 in the morning. In the morning of the day on which you left. So you land 9 hours before you took off. It's not back to the future, it's sort of forward to the past. So in the world of concepts, things can get very, very difficult indeed. But direct experience is very simple. So in general, in this series, we're concerned with unfolding different aspects of what Bhante Sangharakshita sees as fundamentally one spiritual experience, of which going for refuge to the Three Jewels is the central aspect. And this week, we're concerned with the altruistic dimension, the heart dimension, the other regarding dimension, which supports and is supported by the insight dimension. Insight without altruism, without deep feeling for other living beings, is still limited. You can't say it's selfish, but it's non-selfish. It's still subtly caught up with what not I have seen. It's still not fully available to life. On the other side, altruism without insight, without going into how things really are, even that deep feeling for other living beings is still limited. In a way, it's a form of humanitarianism. You could almost say it's like do-gooding of the highest order. I'm not in any way disparaging it, because any act of kindness anywhere in the world is a wonderful thing. But if we are open-hearted but without understanding how things are, it's if we give everything except the one thing that people most need, the key to freedom, which is knowing how things really are. We can't give that, or we can only give it second hand, passing on others' experience, which again is very useful, but it's not the same as when it comes directly from our own experience. So, as the Mahayana, the great-hearted way, the way that knows the empty, insubstantial nature of things, insists, we need both wisdom and compassion. We need the insight aspect, we need the altruistic aspect, and eventually we need them to be inseparable. We need great love and great compassion, which are informed by seeing how things really are. And the voyage to that great experience starts very simply. It starts with maybe coming along to the Buddhist Center and learning Metta Bhavana. More generally, it starts with being prepared to turn towards all the aspects of our experience, including the difficult and unpleasant, even painful ones. In meditation and outside, we are prepared to notice the aches and pains, the sadness, the boredom, the little envious thoughts. And rather than just jumping out away from those experiences with more craving and aversion or dulling out, we turn towards our experience as it is, with as much love and care as we can muster. Being prepared to turn towards dukkha, towards unsatisfactoriness in this way, again and again, with a kindly, nourishing, sympathetic attitude. Which doesn't mean we just give in to the causes of suffering, but we have that attitude to whatever we find in our experience. We're always doing our best to just turn towards it with kindness. Doing that enables us to produce empathy for other people, for other beings. Whilst we're still blocking out our own sense of unsatisfactoriness, our own suffering, we shall always be holding ourselves above the suffering of others, looking at it from a position of denial or from a position of pity. Oh, you poor things down there, you suffer. Oh, I'm really sorry for you. We need to recognize our common situation, that we're all heading for, if not already in the midst of, sickness, old age, and we're all one day going to die. We need to recognize that we're all trying to be happy in our own sometimes weird and wonderful ways. And that we're all constantly constructing unsatisfying worlds for ourselves through the way in which we see ourselves as at the center. Me at the center of my world. All of us here, most of the time, seeing ourselves, you know, me at the center of my world. Always interpreting things in that way, and it never quite works. So it's only when we've really opened to our own experience of unsatisfactoriness that real love and compassion, which come from empathy fundamentally, will start to arise within us. When we recognize the universality of suffering, then we can really empathize with others. When we get down to that most human level, just recognizing that we're all in that position. I've recently been watching the BBC's adaptation of War and Peace. And in there, there's one of the main protagonists is somebody called Prince Andre. And another of the characters, called Anatole Kuragin, attempts to seduce Prince Andrei's fiancée. And Prince Andrei and Kuragin, they're both in the army, and Prince Andrei is on the lookout for Anatole Kuragin, and when he finds him, he's going to challenge him to a duel, and he's going to kill him. But then, they're in the middle of a military campaign, Napoleon has invaded, the Russians are doing their best to defend their homeland, and there's a huge battle at Borodino, and after it, Prince Andrei and Kuragin meet. And they meet in a medical tent, where Kuragin has just had his leg amputated without benefit of anaesthetic, and Prince Andrei is very seriously wounded. And in that moment, they come right down to that basic experience of being two human beings really suffering, and they just reach out to one another. Nothing else matters. Through opening to suffering and empathizing with others, we come to recognize that we're all in the same boat, and that boat is drifting towards disaster. Seeing that, we start learning the skills of a Dharma wayfinder. We start taking responsibility for helping in whatever way we can to turn the boat and steer it towards the farther shore of safety, of freedom. This opening movement of our being, of metta, of compassion, of altruism, can be characterized quite simply as a movement from I to we, from me to us, from mine to ours. So rather than just me at the center of my world, it's now us together in a common world, doing what we can for one another. At this stage, we can't just forget about ourselves, but we can also take others into account, looking after their needs as well as ours, as best we can. And we can start very simple. We just do what we can to help and look after those we're directly in touch with. Those who are in our boat, the boat of our everyday life. Those we come into contact with. Over time, we may go further and start looking for more people to pick up out of the water. But there's plenty of people already that we're in contact with who we can just do our best for. After all, although the Bodhisattva ideal talks in terms of rescuing all living beings from suffering, in our direct experience, the person we're with, or the people we're with, are all we have. As far as I'm concerned, in my direct experience, you are all living beings right now. So I just have to do my best for you, as best I can. So we do our best to treat others well and help them where we can. And we practice this simple, kindly orientation towards life, failing again and again and again, but getting up and having another go, again and again and again and again. And we link with others who are trying to do the same. Which is partly where spiritual community and Buddhist centers come in. And we keep working steadily in this way, turning towards the experiences of our life, practicing metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, and doing our best to move from I to we. And at the same time, we practice looking deeper into the nature of life, trying to see its ungraspable quality. And eventually, if we do these things, something deeper arises. Finally, as the whole process goes further and the insight aspect grows stronger, we move beyond I, we move beyond we move beyond any pronouns at all. There's just loving awareness, without subject or object, caring for whoever and whatever arises within it. And this is bodhicitta. This is the heart mind of awakening. It's a much deeper and more powerful force of compassion. It's a love for life that endures until all suffering has gone. And it's the only answer to the power of the forces of craving and hatred and ignorance that are rampant, that are running amok in the world. The power of these kleshas, these mental poisons, goes very deep in our own minds. And that's what we're seeing played out all around us, in a way. Wherever we look, whatever the circumstances are, what we're largely seeing played out is craving and aversion and ignorance being manifested through people's actions on small scales, on a global scale. So that's, those forces are very strong. But as it says in Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, indeed, goodness is weak, but the power of evil is always great and very dreadful. By what other goodness could evil be conquered if there were not surely the bodhicitta, the awakening mind? So we really want to have an impact on the suffering in the world. We need to just keep taking steps as we can to move in the direction of that egoless compassion, that compassion which has such power, such strength, that it's kept alive through 2,500 years, that it's continued to be a beacon of light in this suffering world. That's what we need to set our hearts on. So now I'd like to look a little bit at bodhicitta, and I'd like to look at some points that Bhante has talked about in relation to bodhicitta, to this union of wisdom and compassion. And the first one in particular is going to take us into a few issues. So first one is that Bhante says that bodhicitta comes out of the tension between seeing the faults, the unsatisfactoriness of mundane life, and wanting to help living beings. So there's a tension, yes, seeing that everyday mundane life is unsatisfactory, something in you wants to pull back from it, wants to not engage with it. So there's a sort of wisdom aspect there, but at the same time, there's a pull, there's a movement, there's a heart wish to help, to make a difference, to help this suffering world. So that tension between wanting to pull back and the move towards, he says, gives rise to the bodhicitta. So it's a strange thing. It's as if we need to cultivate both detachment and engagement at the same time. Learning to help, but becoming less and less caught up. And the less caught up we are, the more we can really help. However, rather than becoming really detached and really of help, really compassionate, we often suffer from what are called the near enemies of these things. Near enemies are things which are similar but not right. They look like they're the real thing, but they're sort of cheap imitations. And these near enemies distort our ability to be of real help. So the near enemy of seeing the faults of samsara and genuinely letting go our grip on it is a kind of isolation and disconnection. We just sort of stop feeling and we withdraw, but we withdraw into a sort of defensive posture. And in doing that, we feel some freedom. Keeping separate isn't a real or a final freedom. We need to learn the greater freedom that comes from freely giving ourselves. And the near enemy of wanting to help living beings is often a kind of losing ourselves in the situation, which often carries on into burnout. And that often comes from a kind of horrified anxiety about how things are. And it seems to me that a lot of our society suffers from a kind of deadly duo of low self-esteem in relation to ourselves and horrified anxiety in relation to what's happening in the world. And that's just a very unfortunate combination. It easily leads us to feel impotent, because what could I ever do about things? And overwhelmed, because it's all so horrifying what's happening that it just really makes us anxious. And this tendency, particularly to overwhelm, seems so common these days, even amongst some Buddhist practitioners, that I'd like briefly to give you a whole list of points to look out for in relation to it. It's wonderful that we care. That we care about things like the refugee crisis. That we care about the warfare in the world. That we care about climate change. And so on. But it's not great if we end up just feeling paralyzed by them and unable to respond effectively. So here are a whole lot of points that we could bear in mind when we're presented with the suffering in the world. I'm just going to touch on some of them. If I go into them and unpack them all, there will be some horrified anxiety about how long this talk's going to go on for. So, yeah, the first one is, watch out for the near enemies of compassion. Watch out for pity, where you're not really kind of engaging with the situation. It's if you're holding back somewhere up here, and there's a sort of sentimental quality to what you're doing. You're not actually empathizing, you're not really meeting with an open heart the situation. Yeah, and watch out for horrified anxiety. Watch out for that sense of, oh dear, which is still actually about us and not really about the situation. If we look at it, what we're responding to is our sense of our reaction, rather than really responding to that person and their suffering. Secondly, be aware of how much you take in of what is disturbing. We are constantly being presented with opportunities these days to watch disturbing images, to be presented by reporters who are themselves often presenting things in such a way that it's almost encouraging us to feel anxious and wound up. We're presented with all these difficult things. And how much of them do we need to see? Do we need to keep watching them? every hour? Do we need to take them in directly? It's like there's a difference between reading about something and here we are in this refugee camp and there is this child. If we really can't imagine what that situation is like, well, maybe it's helpful to see it directly a little bit. But if we can, then does it actually help us to just keep on taking in images like that? And we need to make sure that we stay resourced and balanced. We need to be, thirdly, we need to be aware of guilt. So, for instance, we could think something like, how can I allow myself to be happy when there's so much suffering in the world? So we feel like we kind of ought to be miserable because there is so much suffering in the world. But there's no point in just being part of the problem. We aim to be part of the solution. As it says in the Dhammapada, happy indeed we live, friendly among the haters. Among those who hate, we live free from hatred. Happy indeed we live. So we don't have to make ourselves miserable in some sort of slightly guilty response to the suffering in the world. Fourthly, compassion fatigue isn't inevitable. Those who are further down the path than we are don't suffer from it, won't suffer from it. But for us, yeah, we can just find things too much, and we need to be aware of that. So we need to keep our lives balanced. We need to take time out from focusing on what is difficult. Yes, we can move into a world of suffering, but then we need to move out of it again. We need to come back to top up our resources. We need to make sure that we practice sustainable, compassionate activity. Fifthly, sometimes when we open to a situation of suffering, or sometimes, say, in meditation, we just open to the suffering of the world, and it feels as if our heart will break. So what do? Let it. It won't really. What happens is, there's this overwhelming sense of love, compassion, wanting it to be different. That builds to a crescendo. You may be in floods of tears. And then that wave passes. And life goes on. All that's happened is that your heart has become more open, softer, more responsive than it was before. So be prepared. Don't let your heart open. Everything's impermanent. You know, that wave of that moment won't sort of stop. Life will carry on. Sixthly, hold that wish for suffering to come to an end in your heart before you rush into working out what to do. And very often there's a heart response in this. Oh, I really wish that I could do something about this suffering. And we immediately start thinking, oh, what can I do? But, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't think I can do anything. And that kind of undercuts the whole thing. So to start with, we just need to really hold that heart wish, that longing, that suffering be transformed, that suffering no longer be there. We just hold that like a prayer almost in our heart. Before we worry about whether we can do anything, what we can do, start working it all out, we just hold that deep feeling. That is such a deep human feeling, that is such a deep Dharma feeling, that we need to just stay with that. You know, bodhicitta, I come out of that. And then when we do come to the point of, well, what can I do? Well, we work within our sphere of influence. It's like we do something within what we can influence as a response to what's happening that's moving us. Even if it seems very indirect, even if it feels like, oh, I don't know if that will make much difference, we do what we can do. And we focus on what can be done, not on why it isn't good enough. Which is often what we do. Never mind whether it's going to be good enough or not. This is what we can do, and we're going to do it. Eighthly, it really helps if we empathise in situations where, you know, human beings are causing the suffering. Empathise with the perpetrators as well as the victims. Which doesn't mean agreeing with them, but it does mean that we feel how they are being driven by suffering as well. So in a way, what we see is just a cloud of suffering caused by ignorance, caused by nobody understanding how things are, driven by these deep kind of tendencies, you know, everyone trying to make themselves happy, sometimes at other people's expense. But there's just this cloud of suffering that we're aiming to dispel. So it's not like we just focus on these, the good guys, and they're the bad guys, and we're, yeah, in a way, on a certain limited level, there are good guys and bad guys, but we're not justified in not opening our heart actually to anyone, finally, which is a big ask, but every step we go in that direction, we'll actually feel better. Ninthly, entrust the situation to deeper forces. In a way, everyday me can't fix the suffering in the universe. So it's as if we have to draw on deeper forces. Mind. We'll go more into this next week. As it were, we let bodhicitta act through us. We let the Buddha meditate. We don't try and do it, but we can draw on deeper resources. Tenthly, we can work on the inner level as well as the outer level. Sometimes there's nothing we can do, really, directly on the outer level. But again, rather than just feeling powerless, well, we can at least send metta, karuna. We can practice tonglen, if we know it, that sort of giving and receiving. We can do mantras of bodhisattvas, invoking those sort of qualities of compassion. We can always do those things. And personally, I believe that they will have some beneficial effect. 11th, we need to do our best to let go of hopes and fears and expectations about the outcomes. We just work in the present to do whatever we reckon is going to be most helpful. That's enough. Ideally, we just let the future take care of itself. If we can't keep our mind in the present, then at least let's make positive pictures of the future. The result that we'd like to bring about. But the main thing is that we do what we can to let the future take care of itself, because all those hopes and fears, they just use so much energy. And the fact is, usually we don't know how things are going to turn out. We have no idea, really. But we do what we can do now, wholeheartedly, without letting our energy be sort of drained away by all the hopes and fears. Because usually, however things turn out, what we do now will be of some benefit. You know, even if things turn out badly, our little bit of kindness, our help, our generosity will mitigate the effects of what's going to happen. Yeah. So, whatever. Let's say that climate change is unstoppable. Yeah. Still, doing what we can to not add to the problem, to encourage others to take it seriously, doing what we can to be kind to one another, all that will make some difference. So if we just are standing together as best we can, it's still the right thing to do. If we're going to go down, then we might as well go down helping. Lastly, number 12, being part of a community and having spiritual friends is crucial. Makes such a difference. And this leads us on to Bhante's second point about bodhicitta, which is the bodhicitta tends to arise collectively. It tends to arise where people are joining forces, coming together, sharing their vision, sharing their energy, working together on a common, compassionate project. That's where you tend to get deeper forces, as it were, coming into play. And that's in a way why we're one of the main reasons why we're creating Sangha. It's one of the main reasons why we come together around a centre like this. And the more that we are practicing together, the more we have a common vision, the more that we're doing something beyond ourselves, really sharing together, the more something deeper will come into play. And I do have that sense at times. I have had it over years of being part of a Sangha, being part of the order, sometimes working together, sometimes these days I have the great good fortune quite often to lead large retreats, with maybe sort of 60, 70, 80, 90 people, all practicing together. And it feels at a certain point as if there's something else in the room. It feels as if there's something more than the sum of our parts. Something else has kind of entered into things. Where it feels as if we're all just part of one practice. As if we really have moved from I to we. And maybe even a bit beyond that. Something very, very special. And it's that only comes from that kind of coincidence of wills, a coincidence of hearts. So, through coming together and practicing together in this way, we link in to... In a way, we don't just link into the order. The order, in its turn, kind of links in to the Bodhisattva Sangha. It links into the great Sangha of all those men, women, and other beings who throughout time and space, I've been working for the benefit of all living beings. And thirdly, Bhante talks about how bodhicitta is wisdom and compassion inseparable. So we need both those elements, wisdom, compassion, but coming together as one experience. And this is sometimes explained in terms of the bodhisattva saving beings whilst knowing that everything is insubstantial, everything's like a magical illusion, that there are no beings ultimately to be saved. But for some of us, that viewpoint can seem a little kind of cold somehow. So I tend to prefer to see things in terms of how, moment by moment now, we're actually creating a sense of a subject, a me at the centre of a world, with everything else as other. That isn't something which is given in our situation. That's a filter through which we're seeing how things are. And when with wisdom we realise that that isn't really how things are, when we recognise that that sense of separation is just a conceptual filter that we're putting onto our experience, then we see that we aren't separate from life. And then it becomes natural to treat the whole of life, all living beings, with kindness, because we don't feel separate from them. And in that sense, compassion is woven into the very nature of things. Because we aren't separate from one another, when we see that, then of course we care for one another. Why we don't care is because other people are other people out there and they're nothing to do with us. But we're all intimately to do with one another. On the deepest of levels, we have no idea. So, when we feel that, then we have wisdom, compassion, inseparable. So those are the three points that Bhante makes about bodhicitta. It comes out of that tension to disengage and engage. It comes out of very often collective practice, collective endeavour. It comes out of sangha. And that when it comes, there's that wisdom and compassion completely inseparable. They're different facets of one experience. So let's finish by returning to the Pacific and to these wayfinders, these men and women who navigate between the different islands. Because these Pacific navigators strike me as very good sort of mundane analogues for the bodhisattva. A traditional simile for the bodhisattva is that he or she is like a boatman. And in the Mahayana sutras where this is talked about, it's not about going from this shore of suffering to the other shore of liberation. The image is that the ocean itself is a great ocean of suffering. Almost like made of all the tears of all the suffering living beings ever since the beginning of time. And we're aiming to cross that great ocean to the island of freedom, the island of security, or the other shore of freedom. So without a boatman, without a wayfinder, you're left adrift on the currents of samsara. and you may well eventually drown in that ocean. And the Pacific Wayfinders, like the Bodhisattva, are taking responsibility for everyone on the boat. It's their skills which will lead the boat to its destination. And I mentioned in the first talk that these wayfinders, they stay awake day and night, up to 22 hours out of the 24, making sure that the boat stays on track. Through storms, through fog, through whatever's there. So like the Bodhisattva, they're the ones who are awake when nearly everyone else is asleep. I find something very tender about watching over those who are unaware or vulnerable or defenseless. I even found it on those long plane flights across the Pacific. So all these people just asleep as best they could be. And you're quite exposed and sort of vulnerable when you're asleep. There's a puja that we sometimes do from the Bodhichara of Vatara, which has these lines which go, may the gods protect the helpless, the young and the old, the sleeping, the heedless, and the insane, from all disease and distress. So the Bodhisattva is like a boatman, awake, under the moon, using the stars to steer by, taking everyone to true safety. And for me, the figure at the wayfinder's place at the stern of the boat, in my imagination, is always a female figure. Seeing as Arya Jaya mentioned it's International Women's Day, it's a female figure. But it's not an ordinary female figure. It always seems to be the figure of Tara, the beautiful Bodhisattva of compassion, she who ferries across, as one of her traditional epithets puts it. Tara, who is eternally awake, which is emphasized by her white form, where she has seven eyes of wisdom. Bhante says that for him that emphasizes that her whole body, her whole being, is just made of awareness. And she watches over the sleeping voyagers right through the night. Watches over all of us as she steers us to true safety. And Tara isn't some goddess out there in the universe somewhere. She's a capacity, a power of our own mind that we can learn to contact and identify with. And when we do this, to start with, it feels as if there's kind of a benign presence. You can start to feel as if there's a sort of loving energy that's at work in our lives. And gradually, through faithful Dharma practice, it's as if we become identified with that energy, or we become a channel for that energy, those qualities. And when that happens, then we can turn towards everyone and everything with an open heart. With everyone we meet, we do our best to help them to wake up, to help them to move steadily and inexorably in the direction of complete freedom. And we keep doing this all through our lives. in concert, in harmony with others who are doing the same. And in that context, coming together around that common open heart, that common heart wish to be of help, to be of service to life, something arises which goes beyond anything we can think of as our individual possession or attainment. We're participating in it. It's expressing itself through us. But it doesn't feel like anything that our everyday self is producing. It comes from a much deeper level of mind. That care, that compassion, that love. And it's with those deeper levels of mind that we'll be concerned next week when we have the final talk in our series called Steering to the Deep.